better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spearco with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough, or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, September the 12th, 2024, and this is episode 3557 of the Survival Podcast. And as it is Thursday, it's time for Expert Counsel Q&A show for the week. I've got a great lineup of experts for you right now. If you're in the expert council and you're like, I sent Jack a segment, he's not playing it today. Finally, and I think it was adding a bunch of new blood to the council, and yes, I need to update the expert council page because I haven't. That's on me, not any. Well, it's on everybody except Matt Hill. Matt Hill, you ain't got me your stuff yet. Everybody else has gotten me their stuff. I need to get the expert council page done. Now that the course on cover crops is finished and a bunch of the things that I was working on for the workshop are finished, maybe I can get that done this weekend. But if you're a council member and you sent me something, if there's something wrong with it, I emailed you back and told you there was something wrong with it. If I didn't do that, it's just in the bank, so to say. Because I am content rich for the first time since, well, spring with expert panel content. Don't stop sending it in, guys. And gals, don't stop sending them in because I know that the dry period will come right around the workshop when I need it most. Anyway, who do we got today? Well, we're going to hear, as always, from Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini on the Ron Paul Liberty highlights for the week. And basically, no one should be surprised that Dick Cheney's endorsing Kamala Harris via Liz Cheney, his daughter. He's obviously sending data through her. Who knows what Dick's even doing, if he's even functional at this point. I don't mean that, to take a dig at the guy, although he deserves digs. But it just shouldn't be surprising at all, and they'll talk about that. Michael Melito will talk about choosing a load for both handgun and pistol caliber carbines. Nicole Sauce will talk about storing your homegrown potatoes so they don't turn green and grow shoots before you get a chance to eat them. Sean Mills will talk about thoughts on the Ryobi power station for backup power. I didn't know this thing existed. It's a bit pricey, but it's an interesting tool. Nick Ferguson and Jeff Lawton will talk about how you can guerrilla garden on public property. And you might be like, Nick Ferguson and Jeff Lawton. Well, so I got the question, and I went, this is one of those questions you send to more than one person. You don't let the other person hear the other person's answer, and you play them both back-to-back and see what the differences are. So that's what we did here. So you'll hear from both Jeff and Nick on this one. Jean Pugliano, double duty, hard-working man that he is, has a couple radio questions and an overall economic market update for you. And I'm going to talk about, speaking of markets and economics that are going out there, why is inflation leveling off right now? Like, we all know the CPI should be called the CP lie, right? Consumer price index is bullshit. The prices definitely raise faster than the CPI would indicate. They do things like they change housing in a way that doesn't actually reflect the actual cost of housing for the average person, things like that. But inflation is not as rapidly advancing right now as it was 2 years ago. That is a true statement. It doesn't mean inflation's down. The rate of inflation is lower than it has been. And that's not a terrible thing in of itself, but why? Apparently, because I've been seeing a lot of chatter about this on the news services and all, and apparently a lot of people with PhDs in economics can't agree as to what's going on. And here's the interesting thing. I'm fine with if they all disagreed, but somebody actually had a coherent, logical, rational answer that you could at least say, that might be right. But no, I have not heard a single economic expert, on any of the media services at all, in print or verbally. Now, I'm not saying there might not be an article on Zero Hedge or something that says what I'm going to say when I get to it. I don't know about that. I don't follow every single stinking source. But mainstream? No. Not a single one of these PhD having economic experts that teaches economic theory, advanced eco or whatever bullshit they have at whatever PhD, you know, super high-end school, they wheel these assholes in all the time to tell you what's going on. Not one of them has told you the basic thing that when I say it, you're going to be like, well, yeah, that kind of makes sense. So the redneck hippie duck farmer will explain what the economic PhD holders can't. And it's actually a good thing in a way. In a way, sort of, kind of, but not really. Cryptic, it's on purpose. I want you to listen until the end. Before we get off on this, though, let's go ahead and let me remind you real quick. You can now go to homefoodsystems.com and sign up for the Backyard Cover Crop and Soils course. It's $80 for everybody. It's $65 if you're an MSB member. I think we had about 15 people sign up for it since we released it yesterday. Kind of a soft launch. We're going to do the full launch of this on Monday, but you do not have to wait to start taking it. I just want to tell you that I really put my heart and soul into making this course, you know, an advanced graduate level course on understanding soils and the role that plants play in building soils. Because that's what I hope everybody comes away from this course with an understanding of, that plants build soil. And soil and plants have got to coexist if you want healthy soil. The cover crops are just the plants that we use when we're not growing the productive plants. And it's one of those things, like when I put this course together initially, I thought I'll knock this out in 3 or 4 weeks. And I'll just basically tell people what I do. And then I realized something as I started putting it together. But Jack, why do you do it that way? But Jack, why don't you do this? But Jack, how come you choose this particular mix, this particular year, and on the same exact property with the same overriding goals, you might grow something totally different for a cover crop next year? Jack, why do you not really cover crop in summer, but yet you cover crop in summer? And what does that actually mean? And what do you use for that? Like, as I started pulling at everything, if I were a student and being told this, where would my whys be? This went from being like a three-chapter course to a nine-chapter course. If you take this class, you'll understand some things that will not directly apply to what you do in your backyard, but will apply to why you do what you do in your backyard. Some of those things would be, why do we have so much CO2 in our atmosphere? For all the people worried about global warming, why is the peak of CO2 in the northern hemisphere of the United States, right, North America, why is our peak of CO2 in our atmosphere in spring? Not winter when all the leaves are off the trees, not summer when everybody's running their air conditioner. Why is it spring? Why in the places that we have put in all these beautiful riparian strips along our creeks and streams and rivers in farm country, with all those big wide strips of nature, why does the river still turn into brown mud every year? And why is there absolutely no way to correct it until we correct the root problem? And you could make the riparian strip 3 times as wide, it still won't work. You'll know the answer to that. Why do people think they're creating life with a farm implement we call a plow, when the highway service uses the same implement, the plow, to kill all life in a road base before they put the road on top of the base so the organic matter won't decompose later and settle the road? Have you ever, you see what I'm saying? Now, you might think, Jack, but that doesn't really have to do with whether I plant winter pea or phacelia in my garden. And what's phacelia? You'll learn in the course. No, but it does. And when you understand your why, then you can use your context to dictate your own personal what and how. We have an entire chapter on there on how to do just that. The difference between a strategy, a tactic, and a technique, and why most people go in the wrong order in choosing those things. They want to start with a technique with no tactical approach and no idea of strategy and how you actually use self-asked questions to get there. That's what this course is all about. And again, I would never have taken like 4 months to build, develop, critique, and record this course if I didn't believe that it would be in the best interest of a student to know the answer to those questions. And I could probably sit here and do a whole show just on what you would learn, but I don't like to do that because it's like, I'll give you the answer if you give me money. Hey, I will say this. If you want me to keep making courses like this, people have to buy them because I can't put that kind of extra effort in and not be able to monetize it in some way. But I've always made this offer on anything I've ever done like this. Anybody that buys it decides it wasn't worth the money, you tell me, I'll give you money straight back. I don't care if it's 2 days or 2 weeks or 2 months. Now, if you ask me for your money back in 3 years, I'm probably going to tell you no. But anything reasonable, you know, 60, 90 days, here's your money. I'm sorry it didn't work out for you. I wish more people were like that. I really do, with the things that they're producing. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and hear from Chris Rossini and Dr. Paul on why no one should be shocked that Dick Cheney is actually endorsing Kamala Harris.
Dick Cheney supports Harris? I thought Dick Cheney was a Republican, yeah. Conservative, constitutionalist.
Yeah.
He wasn't, you know, his votes weren't the worst in the world when I knew him in Congress.
Yeah.
But that was just a facade. That's to get his foothold in there. And he had a miraculous career moving up to become president. He's president? Was he president? Yeah, he was president.
Yeah, yeah.
I bet he was the most powerful vice president we ever had. Because he was the one that ran the show.
Put up that first clip. Now, this is from Politico, and it says, this is the story, Dick Cheney supports Harris, says Trump, quote, can never be trusted with power again. And that just, I think that says everything you need to know about the neocons. They're never wrong. They never apologize. This is a man who lied us into war, and everyone knows that he lied us into war, a war in which 1 million Iraqis were killed and thousands of American troops were killed, and he has the gall to say that Trump, for all his faults, should never be trusted with power again. I would say someone like Dick Cheney and the neocons should never be trusted with power again.
There is no doubt that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction. There is no doubt that he is amassing them to use against our friends, against our allies, and against us.
So this is a lie. He knew when he said it, it was a lie, and 1 million people were killed because of that lie. Everyone in the country is sick of the neocons. We talk about polls all the time. People are sick of the endless war. They're sick of what's happening in the Middle East. They're sick of the war in Ukraine. They're sick of the neocons. The people on the so-called left, in America, our friends on the progressive side would say they're not real left, they're neoliberals, but they are now embracing George W. Bush. We remember in the early times when he took us to war with Iraq, we had a lot of the progressives on our side, and now they're rehabilitating Cheney. They're rehabilitating all the neocons who left the Democratic Party in the 50s and 60s and became Republicans in the 70s and 80s, and now they're going back to their roots.
You know, Liz Cheney, she made a name for herself, a negative name, when it came that when they were going to punish those insurrectionists that went to the Capitol and demonstrated and on January 6th. She was the chairman of the committee.
Yeah.
I mean, the Democrats made her the chairman of the committee of investigation. If Trump wins, and he has a chance, I'm sure, that there's going to be more to say about January 6th.
Yeah, I hope so.
And I hope they don't build a statue for her.
Yeah.
They're liable to tear down Jefferson and put up Liz Cheney.
Oh, that'd be something, wouldn't it?
Could he get that? I know, I can't get that bad. That has to be just a ridiculous joke.
Yeah. But, you know, the neocons are parasites. They'll latch on to whatever, they're like ticks. They'll latch on to whatever body has the most blood, and they'll suck it dry, then they'll go to the next one. So I think this whole Cheney thing, this whole Cheney flip-flop, if you call it that, really should be viewed as a cautionary tale to Republicans more than anything else, because they loved putting party over principle when they had the Dick Cheneys and they had anyone coming aboard that would get them elected. But those same Dick Cheneys of the world who put party over principle would then be just as happy to switch over to another party as they wish. So you live by the sword, you die by the sword. So all the Republicans embracing Cheney this whole time, well, this is what you get. You get what you paid for.
So I'm actually a little confused as to why Trump and Vance haven't actually jumped on this and used it to campaign. That's my feeling. There is no one who was going to vote for Trump, who would then not vote for Trump because Trump says Dick Cheney is a warmongering shitbag. They might not even agree with it, but they're still going to vote for Trump. You're not going to lose. What I'm saying is you're not going to lose anybody over this. I also don't think that the left is gaining anything from it. I don't. It's amazing to me that all of a sudden, because Cheney and Cheney-ette hate Trump, that the Cheneys are loved by the left. This is the architect of war. This is everything they hate about Bush Jr. was actually Dick. All right, Dick Cheney was the Bush administration. Bush really was nothing but a figurehead and a name and a guy that could seem like he was a little bit, you know, from the South and do a pretty good play-acting job in a suit. Cheney was the brains and the architect of every single thing that Bush ever did. And he would have never been able to become president. That's why he knew enough not to run for the nomination, which most vice presidents would after back-to-back terms. And it wasn't just because everything got fucked up at the end of the Bush administration with the financial mess. They could have been riding cloud nine and a shoe-in for the Republican over Obama. Like, it could have been a shoe-in for like a McCain or a Romney or something like that. And he still wouldn't have done it. He knew he had done what he had been sent to do, and it was make sure his family's, you know, great-great-great-great-grandchildren would still be richer than God. The man is a disgrace to society. And then there's another word they used in there that I think we actually need a new word for. Neocon. Neocon. Because we have neocons and neolibs. And there's absolutely no difference between them. That's why in the end they always side with each other. There is no difference between the Bushes and the Cheneys and the Clintons and the Obamas on any substantive level. That's why when anybody from the outside comes in, all of a sudden these people that hate it, it's like freaking World Wrestling Federation from 1985 with Macho Man and Hulk Hogan becoming buddies. Except at least that was entertaining and everybody knew it was fake. Except for like your five-year-old little brother that was a dumbass and thought it was real, right? Like everybody else knew it was fake. But here people believe this is all real. If I were Trump and Vance right now, I'd be like, we are so happy that Cheney and her dad endorsed Kamala, because it just proves that everything that we're telling you is the truth. That they're warmongers in the Democrat Party. It's supposed to be the party of peace. It just proves that endless wars are their goals. Of course Dick Cheney would endorse someone who wants to keep this country at war forever, who wants to continuously stick our nose into every foreign conflict there is, that cares not how much they risk the lives of your sons and daughters. Of course Dick Cheney endorsed Kamala Harris, and I would just like to personally say thank you for not endorsing us, because we don't want anything to do with your endorsement, implied or otherwise. I mean, that's hot, but what do I know? I'm just a redneck duck farmer. Now let's talk about pistol caliber carbines and having the pistol that matches the carbine. It's something I know a little bit about. I've got 44s in both. I've got 357s in both. And I have a sweet place in my heart for the 357, which is what this question centers around. And with that, let's hear from expert council member Michael Melito on that topic.
Hey, guys. Happy to be answering questions here for the expert council. Today's question from Chris has a loadout of a revolver and a pistol caliber carbine, both in 357 Magnum. And without getting too nerdy on the numbers he gave, the summation of his question is basically, should I use the same load in my pistol caliber carbine and my handgun? The one for my rifle is a really good one for my rifle and for hunting, but it's a bruiser in my 357 Magnum revolver. He's talking specifically for him about a 200 grain hard cast bullet. Now, while ammo compatibility is a thing, and it's not much ado about nothing, but it's much ado about a niche scenario, is it good and perhaps advantageous that your sidearm and your long gun can fire the same ammo? Absolutely. However, the odds of you doing that, if you need either one of those guns, is slim. What I think is much more important is that you have a good load for both things. For instance, if that's your EDC gun, if you're EDCing a 357 Magnum revolver, your life may depend on that gun. Unless you had to, and if you had to, you could, but unless you had to, I wouldn't run it with the best load for your lever action for deer hunting. I would get a good, street-proven, defensive load that fires point of aim, point of impact when fired by you and is reliable out of your gun. You know, 135 grain Speer Gold Dot, or a good Winchester defensive load, Remington. I'm not here to endorse any brand, but a good street-proven defensive load made for that, made to expand out of your handgun with your barrel length. Then for your carbine, I would get the best load for what you're doing. If you're hunting deer, get a good deer hunting round. If you like the 200 grain hard cast or any other load, 180 grain hard cast, then I would say go with that. Everything is a compromise, and I think that having the best load for the best thing in your gun is the better trade-off. Now, I know some lever guns may have issues loading some shorter 38 special loads if that's what you're running for defense. Maybe you load your carbine load a little bit longer than would fit in your revolver. So you might want to tweak them a little bit so that both fit in both. If you run into an emergency scenario where you need to put one ammo into another gun, it's still going to work. It's not going to be ideal, but that ammo is certainly better than no ammo. But again, I would have the best load for the task, especially if you're talking about a, let's call it grid up scenario, a good tailor-made defensive load with all the good modern technology, bonded bullets, good hollow point expanding, factory load, low flash powder, all the things. And since that 200 grain hard cast, you're probably making your own ammo. Maybe you consider something like adding, you know, 148 grain semi-wad cutter, which is a pretty good proven load in lieu of a hollow point, and you're probably going to be able to use the same powder, same primers. You just have an extra mold if you're thinking about that for stockpiling when ammo gets, let's say, harder to get than it is now.
So I agree with everything that Michael said there. I do wonder how big a deal it would be if you were using the hunting round in a pistol, though, for real. And I'm not trying to be like, oh, I can shoot anything, right? Because I don't really like guns that cause me to have pain, okay? But I've just never fired anything out of a 357 revolver that was in any way not manageable, especially in a defensive situation where you're zoned in. So I don't know that it would even be that big of a deal, other than things like over-penetration and what have you, because this is one of the issues that you run into when you step into this world of pistol caliber carbines and you intend to use it on things like big game animals. The gain in velocity from, let's say, a 4 or 5 inch revolver barrel with a gap between the cylinder and the barrel, there is some loss of pressure there, okay, is significant when we go into a closed breech, let's say 16-inch Marlin lever gun or even a 20-inch Marlin lever gun barrel. And as much as it appears as there's a decent bump in velocity, when you do the math and you look at the bump in energy foot-pounds, it is exponential. It is not a little difference. And where that matters is when we're using a design to expand at pistol velocity and impact energy round, like he was talking about, like a Speer Gold Dot or something like that. That round at it, you know, let's say you end up with like a 25 yard shot on a deer, right? And you have that in a Marlin lever gun. That will have more impact velocity at 25 yards than if you were to take that handgun and point blank press it against the side of that animal and shoot it. And what that often leads to is an overexpansion of these handgun rounds that were designed for human defensive purposes, basically shooting two-legged rats instead of four-legged deers. And so you really don't want to go the other way, is what I'm getting at. You do not want to take these rapid expanding, moderate velocity, moderate energy rounds and put them into a lever gun and then rely on that to get a good double lung shot on a deer. Like, so that's why I'm in complete agreement. And I think one of the things you need to think about here is this contingency idea. Well, the same rounds will go on both weapons if the apocalypse comes or whatever. Yeah, and at that point, you won't really care. Okay? You understand what I'm saying? Like, if you were going to plan for that, if we're going to just take this to the extreme and say, I'm going to plan for that, then what I would say is have the vast majority of your ammo suitable for use in the carbine. Have enough handgun ammo to practice with, which I have no problem, by the way, with you practicing with 38s. In fact, I would advise that because it costs you less money. And you carry your 357 defensive rounds in that handgun. And if we have the apocalypse, when you run out of those, just put the rifle ammo in and it'll be fine. I promise you, when you're fighting off three zombies, you won't notice the recoil. And I'm going to say this, too, though, about your chosen round. I love it. I love it. I love it. I have killed a lot of deer with 357 Magnums, both in handgun format and in rifle format. It is one of the best little rounds on the planet for deer-sized game. If I was going to go handgun hunt elk or something, I have a Ruger Red Hawk 44. I would take that over a 357 for an animal of that size. And I would have to really have the time on that hunt before I would give up hunting with a rifle, because that's kind of a hunt of a lifetime thing. But, you know, deer size, antelope, that size and down, the 350 feral hogs and all, just an amazing, amazing round. I actually did an episode on pistol caliber carbines like 15 years ago. I'll see if I can find it. If I do, I will add it to the show notes. With that, now let's hear about storing potatoes from someone that knows about that, Nicole Sauce.
Howdy, TSP. Nicole Sauce here from the Living Free in Tennessee podcast and the Self-Reliance Festival with a question from Evett. Evett asks, how can I store my homegrown potatoes without turning green and growing sprouts? We are getting good at growing food, but not so good at storing and preserving. I've tried to store potatoes in a sack, in a dark cupboard, in a bucket of sand, in cardboard boxes with newspaper. None of these methods kept the potatoes fresh for long. Any information on this topic of storing and preserving would be greatly appreciated. It's not Everett, it's Yvette. I'm sorry, I read that wrong. Anyway, so potatoes are something that, depending where you live in the world, it may be harder to create the environment that you need for longer-term storage, but it is possible. So the prevailing advice on the internet is 50 degrees and 90 to 95% humidity. What that means is if you live in a dry, arid area, you need to think about how am I increasing the humidity for potato storage? And really what you're doing is kind of mimicking what they would be like underground without soil contact, because soil contact invites pests and can speed rotting, which is why just leaving them in the ground doesn't always work. Although, where I live in Tennessee, if I leave potatoes in the ground, I get more potatoes next year. So that's also a climate-specific thing. So here's some things about potatoes on just the curing and storage side, and then we'll move on to other ideas. First of all, when you get your potatoes out of the ground, do knock off the clods, but don't rinse them off. I have found in general garlic and potatoes that leaving, like not scrubbing them, really helps them store better. And you could say it's because there's an enzyme on there. I tried to find out the official why and haven't found out the official why. But I do know this. When you wash something, you subject it to damage. And that would be causing a wound on the flesh of the tuber, which can speed rotting. So the first thing you do to cure your potatoes, because they just were ripped out of the ground, which was sad and maybe hurt them a little bit, especially if you hit one with your shovel, wound healing. You do this at 60 to 65 degrees with higher humidity. So you don't plunge them cold right away. You leave them warmer. And that happens for about 3 to 5 days. So that outer, like the skin of the potato, if you will, gets a little bit thicker and cures. And then you want to reduce the temperature slowly, so you don't want to just like plunge them straight into the freezer, obviously, or your fridge from that situation. Dropping below 45 degrees speeds up sugar conversion from the starch that's in them, and this can lead to them degrading faster over time, but actually on the commercial side, because I went to the commercial side to really see, I went separate from like what all the whole old-timey people do. in a commercial setting, they just make sure when they heat them back up, like allow them to get up slowly to temperature rather than putting them out in a like straight up sunny area, right? So in commercial setting, they will store potatoes 45 and below, between 38 degrees and 45 degrees with air movement and high humidity. And that's how they're able to store them long term. I was unable to find if they also remove oxygen, so have them, but they probably do, by the way. I just couldn't find corroboration of that and did not find somebody to call to ask them how they store that. I know they do that with fruit. So anyway, so they're going 38 to 40 degrees for the ones you buy in the grocery store, quote unquote, fresh, that are usually about a year old, and 45 degrees if they're going to be made into potato chips or, you know, French fries or something like that. So if you want to have longer term storage at home, you want to keep the temperature low. And when you're ready to use them, bring them up to temperature slowly and handle the potatoes carefully so they don't get bruised. And then the other thing is at that higher humidity of 90 to 95%, what can happen is water like sticks to the outer skin and like condensates. And if that happens, that can speed up the going bad of the potato. So you want to move air if you can. And then you want to store them in a way that air can move. This is actually why a root cellar works really well for storing potatoes. And that's because, you know, my root cellar is around 55 degrees at the time of year I'm using it. And in a root cellar that's just dug into the ground, you purposefully leave soil contact. So you don't just like concrete it in, you let the soil be there, and that's adding humidity to your root cellar. And this creates an environment that sort of mimics the potatoes being underground, but they're not having dirt contact. So that being said, also store in a cardboard box or some way that they're getting some airflow around them. So I use cardboard boxes and maybe three potatoes deep with holes in the sides so that there's airflow. With this, I haven't had a lot of trouble of them not lasting as long as I expect, but my experience in a state or part of the world, really, where I have higher humidity is I don't struggle with keeping the humidity up so much. In fact, we have the opposite problem. I store potatoes in a root cellar that does not have soil contact. So mine is actually concrete from October to late February. And then about late February, they start growing eyes. Like the eyes start putting out sprouts. And that's how I know it's time to start getting ready to plant them, because you plant potatoes in Tennessee in March. And so when I see that happening, I just, you know, get ready to put them back in the ground, because that's part of the cycle of the potato. If I didn't have so much natural humidity in the air, I would think about having an earth contact root cellar. But I do store them in cardboard boxes. I do not circulate the air, and I do inspect the potatoes about every 2 weeks. My official advice is inspect weekly, but what I really get around to is about every 2 weeks. Sometimes I'll go 3 weeks. And what I'm looking for there is any potato that when I touch it, it seems like it's not as firm as it used to be. I'll pull those out for use that week. And anything that looks like it has a bad spot developing, because the thing that'll make your potatoes rot fastest is one goes bad in the very middle, and then it makes everybody else bad in that box very quickly. And then it brings pests in, and that's no fun either. Keep your potatoes away from stored onions, because that can speed up degradation. And as things warm in your area, if your storage area is also warming up, you're going to see them start to put out little rootlets, basically. And you can just cut those off and use the potatoes right away, or you can put them aside for your seed potato for the next year. Finally, variety matters. So red potatoes, like the thin-skinned red potatoes, do not store as long in my root cellar as a like nice, deep, skinny, russet potato. Those last longer. So when I get two kinds of potatoes in my root cellar, I'll use the ones with the thinner skins first, and then I will go into the russet. And then, like, when my fancy varieties start eyeing out early, I just put them aside and let them do that, because they're going to go back in the ground to make more potatoes. this is advice you can adjust to your situation, right? So you know that your core premise is, you know, 45 to 55 degrees, 90 to 95% humidity, and then keeping enough airflow that they don't pool up water, and inspecting them about once a week. If you don't have a root cellar, this means you can find, if you have a basement space, you know, check out how that works temperature rise. The lower you're getting the temperature, the better. If you want to make a root cellar, you can look at all the creative ways to do that, you know, like by burying a freezer in the ground or something. But I'll say this, local farmers here will put them in their barn under a blanket, and those last for darn near 3 months that way here. So adjust as needed. Find a nice, cool place in your house. It is important also that they are dark. So where, however you store them, put them in a place where they're not getting sunlight or light. So maybe a closet in your house if you have that. Or like if I get potatoes before October, which I do, that I'm storing, then I'm just going to transition into my root cellar. My root cellar is too warm in the height of the summer. And so I put them under my bed, because that's the coolest room in the house, because I like to sleep cool. So I keep that room cool, and that really helps. In the end, the other question I would have is, what's your expectation for fresh storage? Because I'm going 3 to 5 months on mine. Are you trying to store them for a year, or are you trying to store them for longer than that? Or are you only get a month or two? That's all a very different cycle. But I would go back, look at the variety of potatoes you're growing and how long they store, and if they are thicker skinned or thinner skinned, look at how you're curing your potatoes, and then find ways to mimic a low temperature, dark, higher humidity storage solution, but with enough airflow that you're not going to mildew them or do more damage than you were expecting. And then just accept that the cycle, it's like you're riding the cycle, right? When it's their time to eye out, they're going to eye out, and that's how you know it's time to plant them. If you want to extend storage beyond that, your other option is to parboil them and dehydrate them, or to can them, and then you'll have potatoes at those times of year when your potatoes are now growing, but you don't have any in your cold storage. I really hope this helps you address some of the storage issues you have. Guys, don't forget, if you want to learn heritage skills and get to know your tribe in person, we've got an awesome event coming up in Tennessee, October 5th and 6th in Camden at Special Operations Equipment, which means while you're there, you can buy some of the cool t-shirts that Jack and I wear all the time, or get other gear because you have access to the store in the factory. You get to see the sewing factory. It's a really cool place to hang out. Jack Spierko is speaking there as well, and I hope to see you. SelfRelianceFestival.com. Make it a great week.
Well, great stuff as always from Nicole Sauce. And I did find that episode that I did on pistol caliber carbines. And I was wrong. It wasn't 15 years ago. 16 full years ago. Episode 46, the pistol caliber carbine and survival planning. If you want to go, you know, have a blowback to that episode, yeah, it is in the show notes today, right under Michael's bullet point. Now moving on, let's hear from Sean Mills about something I didn't even know existed, and it's really not my thing because I'm a DeWalt guy, but I bet DeWalt makes something just like it. The Ryobi power station, using it as a backup power source, and whether that's a good idea or not, what the limitations are on what it will really do for you.
Hey everybody, it's Sean Mills with Hack My Homestead, and today I've got an expert panel question coming in from Zeb. Zeb says, would you utilize the new Ryobi Power Station inverter as a backup to a gas generator, or is there a better product in your opinion? I already have multiple Ryobi batteries for my tools, so I was looking for a backup to my generator with less maintenance needed than a gas generator. If I already have the batteries and the $649 price tag, is the tool only worth it in your opinion? And if not, do you have better suggestions? It appears it will run a fridge or freezer, which is my main concern and need. Thanks.
Yeah, actually, I didn't know about this product. I have the 40-volt Ryobi tools as well. And yeah, this is a pretty neat little product. So for those of you guys that haven't seen this, it's essentially a little inverter. And you plug four of the 40-volt Ryobi batteries into it. And you plug it into the wall, and so it's a charger Or you can actually utilize the power in the batteries to run the inverter. And as Zeb mentioned in his question, it can power, you know, up to 1800 watts. They say 3000 watt surge, but, you know, 1800 watts should be enough to power any refrigerators or freezers for the most part. Obviously, there's a wide range of compressors on the market, but generally, if you can get 1500 watts and 3000 watts surge, you can power just about any fridge or freezer that's out there. Now, one of the things to remember is the biggest batteries that Ryobi makes in that 40 volt is a 6 amp hour battery. And so we always take watts to be equal to amps times volts. So if we take that 40 volts times the 6 amp hours, then that tells us that we have an available 240 watt hours per battery. And there's four batteries that go on this. So it's important to understand that while it will power 1800 watts, you know, or up to 1800 watts in terms of an appliance, it has less than 1000 watt hours of available capacity for you to actually utilize. So that's something to keep in mind. Now, personally, I have a fridge and a chest freezer that both use less than 1000 watt hours per 24 hours of being on. But I also have, you know, components that I selected specifically for the fact that I live off grid. So it's always good to start with the data point of what is the maximum surge and the data point of how much power does this device use over a 24 hour period. And then once you have those two pieces of information, you can make sure that the inverter can A, handle the load, and B, handle it for the period of time that you want it. So well, I would say that $650 for, you know, this device, if you already have the four batteries, I think it's a pretty neat little device. You could put it in a vehicle. There's a lot of different things that you could do with this to power small loads here and there, you know, that you need. It's probably not the greatest option to rely on as a backup to a gas generator just because of what I mentioned. You don't have the amount of storage to utilize over a long period of time. You can go to my YouTube channel, just search for Hack My Homestead and find videos of me building a DIY, you know, essentially it's a EcoFlow Delta Pro system. And I'm actually getting ready to put another one out with a bigger battery bank. And so something to look at, you know, doing a DIY version, you can typically use better components. Having the individual components means that if one part goes bad, you can replace that part instead of the whole thing just turning into a big paperweight. So, you know, building one of those yourselves, or you could just go the route of, you know, buying one of the Blue Yetis or Anchor or Jackery, you know, or EcoFlow systems that are on the market for this. They do have much higher storage than four of those Ryobi batteries have. So again, get those data points, what you actually want to power, and then use that to determine whether or not this is a good option for you. For me personally, like at my house, it would be a fine option. That being said, if I wait for sales, for $650, I can go buy a backup gas generator from Harbor Freight that will probably last me a decade or more. Now, I do have to obviously keep oil and gas and everything else on hand to keep that thing running, but I can tell you that the most reliable generator that I currently own is a Predator generator from Harbor Freight that I bought in 2013, and it's still running strong. And so take that for what it's worth. I think it's a cool product. I think it can do some things, but once you know what your power needs are, you might decide you need something bigger than that. All right, guys, keep getting those questions in the jack, and I'll keep getting them answered.
So I pretty much agree with everything Sean said. I guess the one thing would be, since it's pretty much snap batteries in, snap batteries out, if you're using this system on 40 volt and you have a lot of batteries, like because you're running power tools all the time and you have, you know, 8 or 12 of them, well, you have 2 or 3 fully charged battery banks available, assuming you keep all your batteries charged all the time, which is something I try to do. It's still pretty expensive relative, I think, to what you get. I will say this, the retail is $650, They're being sold right now on Amazon for like $570. And if you do want one, I have a link in Sean's bullet point that will take you to Amazon where you can spend less to get it. I did verify it is what they're talking about. Anyway, moving on. The next one I'm going to play back to back. I'm going to play Nick first because Nick reads the whole question. This is a question about guerrilla gardening in public spaces in Central Florida. I think this is a great idea. Let's hear what Nick and Jeff say. Since it's them answering the same question, I won't be back until both of them give their answer. Maybe I'll have a few inputs because I haven't heard what they have to say either yet.
Hey there, Nick Ferguson from Homegrown Liberty and RarePlantStore.com here with an expert counsel answer for Benjamin on guerrilla gardening. He says, how can I effectively ditch garden in Central Florida? I live in a typical suburban neighborhood, and I'm curious if it's worthwhile to establish low-maintenance edible plants in surrounding unmowed public or government-owned land, basically anywhere they will be left alone. My goal is to create a future foraging resource, or at the very least, enrich the area to reduce the chances of people knocking on my door for food in tough times. I'm specifically interested in plants that require minimal care and can be easily spread in large quantities via seeds or bulbs. What are the best options for this type of self-sustaining, low-effort gardening? Thanks, Ben. Well, Ben, my first go-to would be Seminole pumpkin or most anything in the Moschata species. They do well in the heat and humidity. They thrive on neglect. And it's a great carb source for both animals and people as well. So yeah, moringa is another one that I'd consider. Seminole pumpkin, turmeric, gingers, not so much for the food value, but for medicinal and, you know, flavor. Suriname spinach, Malabar spinach, longevity spinach, all three of those would be great. Dwarf everbearing mulberries, sweet potatoes, figs, most of those you can scatter as seeds or very easily as small cuttings. I mean, figs, you just take a handful of figs in the wintertime, fig cuttings, and just jab them in all over the place, and you'll have a whole bunch of figs popping up all over the place. That's really, really simple and easy. Don't forget to consider some medicinal plants. One of our staples that seems to be preventing any colds or flu in our family for years now is Andrographis, a.k.a. King of Bitters. It's super easy to grow from seed and is a phenomenal herbal medicine. It should be essentially a self-seeding annual / perennial there in your climate. Another thing you should consider is elephant garlic. It's a perennial leek that does well in the heat and humidity, practically bulletproof, comes back for generations with zero maintenance or intervention. Consider some other good perennial bunching onions. Always great to have ingredients to add flavor to foods. I'm sure Jeff has a bunch of good suggestions, but those are the ones I can think of off the top of my head. Hope that helps all of you Florida people out. Speaking of Florida, I'm planning a trip at the end of October through Tennessee to South Carolina down the west coast of Georgia. The east coast of Georgia. The east side of Georgia on the coast. Then down to the Orlando area. Just sent a few emails out to people who've been on the waiting list. So if you happen to be in those regions and want to get on the tour, better send me an email quick to nick@homegrownliberty.com. Thanks for the great questions. I'm Nick Ferguson. Do good things.
Hi, Jeff Lawton here, coming to you from the Dead Sea Valley in Jordan. And we have a question here about establishing worthwhile low-maintenance edible plants in unmown public or government-owned areas. And they want to know what be my suggestions for planning in that sort of zone in Central Florida, which is kind of subtropic, similar to where I live. So I'd go for things that are perennial and long lasting, and most people don't recognize. You could do sweet potato. A lot of people wouldn't recognize sweet potato, especially the one with a red tip, and it's perennial and just keeps growing. You always get tubers out. Then you've got Kang Kong, which is another Ipomea. Sweet potatoes, Ipomea vitatus. Kang Kong in damp soil to quite wet soil, it's the fastest growing leaf crop in the world, and it's an Ipomea, but it has a leaf crop, and it's an Ipomea aquatica, grows from cuttings, easy to grow, perennial, as long as you don't get heavy frost. And then I would also go cassava. It's a very valuable tuber, and most people wouldn't recognize it. You could also do taro, which will grow very well there, and cocoa yam. Taro is a colocasia, and there's quite a few varieties and some very good ones. But cocoa yam is exoma, slightly different, and slightly different tuber. And then I would look at edible hibiscus, which is a leaf crop, and again a great perennial. Most people wouldn't recognize it. And then you have the edible arrowroot, and you have some very good quality edible arrowroot. Looks like canna lily but much larger, and you have some very good edible versions. And then as climbers, you could have climbing yam, which is a Dioscorea and perennial, goes would die back in winter, roots would get very big, and then it grow again every summer. And so all of those plants would not be recognized, would carry on growing with very little attention, and you'd have an emergency food supply. So if you're pulling them out to people, they'd know what to harvest, wouldn't be a problem. There you go.
So I have a few things to add here. Number one, Central Florida and South is full-on subtropics to even tropic, and most things will survive the winter if they're perennial. They're also ground zero for invasive plants, and so some of the things that might have been mentioned might be on some lists that maybe you don't need to be seen planting. That doesn't mean I wouldn't plant them. I would totally plant them. But just as an example, Ipomaea aquatica, I grow that here. It's technically not supposed to be grown here in Texas, but it's no risk here in this part of Texas because it can't make it through the winter here. Just because something can survive the winter in like freaking Corpus Christi doesn't mean it can in Texas. This is not, hey, look how Texas big it is. Right? Like, it's just a fundamental reality. If you had a scale model puzzle of the United States, and you took the Texas puzzle piece out and put the southern tip of Texas on the tip top of the northern panhandle of Texas, Texas would then be well into Canada on your puzzle. Right? It's not, again, it's not bragging. It's just I'm trying to make a point that the climate types are very different north to south in a state this large. And so the ban that they have is generally always statewide. Where if you're in Central Florida and you're doing some of these things, just accept you're introducing those things into that ecosystem. And unless they're readily already around, then you might think twice about something like that. Because it will make it through. And Ipomaea aquatica is one of the fat, and I love it. It's delicious, and it's certainly something I would consider again. But do you need to, or is it already invaded the place? And this is kind of where I would go from there. It would be a good idea for you to look around and see what are the things you can forage that are already there, and then maybe use that for some of your ideas. Let's talk about another Ipomaea species that Jeff mentioned with sweet potato. I think it's a great idea. Honestly, a hell of a lot of landscapers are landscaping with sweet potatoes now. I see sweet potato vine all over in like yuppie areas of Dallas-Fort Worth, all over, and they rip it all out in the fall and plant pansies. So it's something that's probably already being used in landscaping, but it leads me to one of those invasive species that's no longer, I don't consider an invasive species invasive once it's naturalized. That's what I'm saying. And there are multiple species of wild yam that grow all over the place in Florida. That would be worth looking into. There's certain date palm species that will do well in Florida that are smaller palms where you don't have to like shinny up them like you're on a TV show or something. There's a lot of stuff like that. And there's two places I would look for some ideas beyond the great advice you got from Nick and Jeff. One is I would check out Robin Greenfield's YouTube channel. I had Rob on years and years ago while he was in Florida, living in Central Florida in a little 100 square foot house that it was a tiny house that was half tent, honestly, in a backyard, and he had to eat what he grew or foraged or hunted or fished for a year. That was the deal he made when he started that project. And so he got really good at finding things like wild yams in Florida. So by watching his channel, you may find that there are things where you want to plant that are already there that you could be using. It'd be what I'm saying. The other person who I would check out is, I can't remember the dude's name, but I'll put links to Rob's YouTube channel and the dude from Eat the Weeds. I'll put it to his website. Now, he hasn't been active for several years. I mean, even like his social media stuff like Instagram hasn't been active. But he does exactly what it sounds like. Goes out and takes these plants that we think of as weeds or whatever, many of them invasive species, and says, this is what it is. This is what you can do with it. This is how you know it's the thing that you're looking for and not something that's going to make you sick or kill you. Right? This is when you can find it, time of year type thing. He has a whole formula to make sure you don't eat the wrong thing. Where's he based? Florida. Florida. So between those two, you may find, one, that there's already things there, or two, you may find that there are things that are already there but not where you want them that you can just move. And another species that I would that I wish I lived in Florida, because, you know, I have a friend who literally calls me the pepper whisperer. I have never had success growing them here, and they grow like weeds. And they are, you know, short-lived perennials in South Florida. They're like the official, like the plant of St. Augustine. So if you're anywhere south of St. Augustine, you're going to have no trouble at all with them. Detal peppers. And if you can find a place where like a little shrub or something would be left alone, then I would grow detal peppers. They are one of the greatest little hot peppers. They're very hot. They're kind of habanero-like, but they're shaped differently. They're smaller. And if you ever go to St. Augustine and you walk through like the streets in Old Town and all, they're in every giant pot in every place. Anyway, with that, that's a little longer add-on than I planned. But let's move on and hear from John Pugliano on an economic update, but also a couple radio questions.
Hello, TSP. I've got some radio and investing questions. I'm going to combine them all into this one segment. I'm going to go quickly because I also want to get in a market update because there's been quite a bit of volatility in the markets. So first radio question comes from Raymond. It's not actually a question. He just mentions that there's a video out there from S2 Underground that shows you how to encrypt a radio for secure communications. And I don't want to say much on this other than, you know, there's a lot of discussion in the prepper community about encryption, because encryption is illegal on the public frequencies. So that's ham, family service, CB, GMRS. On all those frequencies, you're not allowed to use encryption. Now, of course, just because it's illegal doesn't mean people don't do it, and I'm not going to get into all that either. But here's the bottom line. If you really think you need encrypted secure communications, well, even though it's not permitted to be used on the public frequencies, it is allowed on commercial radio frequencies. So if you think of a Motorola radio for businesses that operates in the UHF and VHF segment of the bands, and those type radios are available in handhelds, mobiles, or base stations, well, because they're used for commercial use, many of those radios do have encryption built into them. And also because they're using just UHF and VHF, many of those could also transmit on the more public bands like GMRS or ham radio. So if you really want encryption, and all the things that people are talking about on social media about encrypting on the ham bands basically, is they're just using these commercial radios. So you can buy a commercial radio, and there's no secret or, you know, decoder ring that you need to learn how to encrypt it. You just simply read the manual. So I personally don't use encryption. If I needed it, I would know how to do it. And so I'll just leave it at that. Now, the next question on radios comes from Michael, and he likes to go four-wheeling in the lake dunes up in Michigan, and he wants to have communication between the four-wheelers and their base camp, and it's all within a 1 to 3 mile radius, and he's asking what's the best, you know, radio use for that. Well, Michael, unless you have a big desire to get a ham radio license, then I wouldn't even fool with ham radio. I'd stick with Citizens Band. I mean, the application you're talking about is the perfect communication envelope for CB over that 1 to 3 mile range. And if I were to do it, I'd go old school and go with one of those long stainless steel whip antennas. These things are like 108 inches. Or you can go with a slightly smaller version and even better, put a 6-inch spring base on it. That would be really durable for your four-wheeling. You should easily get the distance and coverage you want within those sand dunes. The radios are inexpensive. and the accessories are readily available. It's all pretty much plug and play. Everything's channelized, so there's not even any frequencies to worry about. I mean, it's totally operator friendly. I would go the CB route, and the only thing that might change my mind is that CB is going to operate with AM amplitude modulation. And on the four-wheelers, you could get some noise or, you know, ignition static noise on the radio. And that can be overcome with filters or a common mode choke. But if you can't filter that noise out, then going to something like GMRS is FM, and that'll give you a clear audio signal and shouldn't have any ignition noise in it. But again, the problem there is you're not going to get the distance that you will out of the CB, and I also don't think it's as cost effective. So start with a CB and see how that works for you. Now the next question is a financial one. It's actually about land. I think his name is Sim, and he says that he wants to either gift or sell at a very low price some property to his two adult sons. And he says, is this something, you know, where he should just, you know, give it to them as a gift at no cost, or does it have to be sold for a particular amount? You know, he just really wants to pass this on to them so that they don't have any debt or any financial obligations on it. What I would recommend is an option that you didn't say, which is a trust. And the reason I bring that up is because you also mentioned some clauses you want to put in there, like some conflict resolution or first right of refusal if one of the brothers wants to sell it. You know, things like that are covenants on the property that I think would be best served with a trust. Something else you didn't mention, but I would be potentially concerned with the cost basis in the event that your sons, you know, in the future would want to sell the property. I think that if you structured it the proper way in a trust, you could probably keep yourself as the trustee until your death and have it structured so that when you die, your sons become not only the beneficiaries, but also the trustees. And then at that point, they inherit it at the value of the land on the day that you would pass away. And that stepped up cost basis could potentially help them avoid capital gains should they decide to sell the property or at least drastically reduce them. Bottom line here is, I highly recommend you talk to an attorney, and specifically an attorney that deals with real estate in your area. Okay, so real quick, I want to get to a market update. The stock market, and in particular the S&P 500, has been incredibly resilient this year. Last month, when it looked like there was a major pullback going on, the S&P 500 only got down a little bit below its 100-day moving average, and the total peak-to-trough movement in early October was something like maybe a little more than 8%. So it really wasn't even qualifying as an official correction. And then just recently this week, it looked like we might be getting another pullback, but so far as I record this, the S&P looks like it stayed above its 100-day moving average and actually has bounced up above its 50-day moving average. So in short, what I'm trying to say here is that even with all the election uncertainty and what appears to be a slowing economy, the market's pretty content. And between now and the election, barring some real black swan event like, you know, perhaps another assassination attempt, I think the S&P 500 is going to stay above its 200-day moving average. So I'd watch those levels. Unless the S&P drops down below those, I think it's probably smooth sailing until the election. And for now, it does appear that the market's pricing in a Harris win. And in terms of the overall performance of the stock market, that may not be such a bad thing, depending upon how divided government is. And I think divided government is very much what the market is counting on and hoping for. As long as the Republicans can hold on to either the House or the Senate, or perhaps both, and what kind of majorities they can maintain. So that's what we want to keep an eye on, and that will also be the subject of my presentation at Jack's Fall Workshop. So I look forward to seeing everybody down there in November. And as always, thanks for the questions. This is John Pugliano from Investable Wealth and the Wealthsteading Podcast.
I'm just going to say about the end part, and this is a prognostication, not a disagreement. I think a divided government is going to be highly unlikely this time around. I think if Harris manages to win, that the Democrats will probably take over everything. I think the more likely thing to happen, given where things are at the moment, is going to be Trump with a Republican House and a very, very tiny margin Republican majority in the Senate. That's what I think. Now, I wouldn't make any life decisions on that because I'm certainly not. That's just what I think. Anyway, moving on from here, let us go and talk about my subject today, which is, well, what's up with inflation? And what maybe you want to talk about this today, it should be a pretty brief segment for me so we can get wrapped up for the week, is I've just heard so much lately about, well, inflation's down, inflation's down. All right, well, it's not. The rate of inflation is slower than it has been, would be the proper way to describe it. For inflation to be down, you would have to have deflation, meaning prices are dropping. So prices aren't dropping. They're not even staying level. They're extremely elevated, which you know if you buy stuff. And then now they continue to go up very slowly versus very quickly. That's inflation leveling off. That is inflation moderating. It's a lot of things. It's not inflation going down unless you're a complete literalist and you simply mean the inflation rate is in decline, which is still inflation, which still means up, single movement, up. But I think it's a valid question, and it's not the bullshit claims that everything swell and Bidenomics is working that has me doing this subject today. It is the sheer number of experts who I have heard or read explaining all these various theories about how is inflation down? Again, we're saying the wrong words there. How is inflation being mitigated to what we would have considered a reason? If honestly, you know, 1.5 to 2.5% inflation, even with the CPI lie, if we didn't have a few years in between with double-digit inflation, would be something people would have been able to adjust to and absorb fairly well. When you've had the cumulative cancer of this inflation, and it outpaced the increase in income that usually goes along with it, well, that's how you end up where we are now, where people can say, well, inflation is only 2%, but you know what? It doesn't matter because I went to the grocery store, spent $60 or $100 or $200, came out with one or two bags of food where I used to be able to bring this much food home for like $50. But yes, the continuous upward pressure has been massively decreased, and they don't know why. Some are saying, well, it is actually Joe Biden's plan and the Inflation Reduction Act kicking in, and this is just signs of the economy improving. And there's not a person out there who works for a living that ain't earning like $250,000 or more that believes that bullshit unless they just want to because they're a Democrat. But if it was a Republican in office, they would know it's a lie. And they would accept that it's a lie because they do know it's a lie, right? That's a bullshit answer. No, the economy's not getting better. The economy's not getting better. The economy's not getting better. And we're having the number of jobs for American citizens has actually gone down this year, even though there's, you know, new jobs, but all the new jobs have been taken by low-dollar immigrant labor. That's not a political statement. That's a factual statement. So this idea that inflation has been mitigated because government did a good job or because the Fed raised rates, there's a piece to that that's true, but it's not the actual answer. So that's one answer. The other answer is from mostly people on the right who are also having their judgment clouded because they hate the left. Well, it's not going down at all, and it's just because they lied. Which, like the interest rate claim, is a little bit of truth and a whole bunch of nonsense. There is no doubt that prices were rising faster 2 years ago than they are today. Anybody with a brain knows that. So the CPI had us at like 12% a couple of years ago at the highest, and we were probably more at like 18 to 20 in reality. And now they say it's like 2.5, and it's probably more like 3.5, 4.5. But that's general lies, right? It's still less new inflation than there was, with cumulative being the problem. So why? Because everybody that talks about this subject invokes shit like Weimar Germany or Nigeria with trillion-dollar bills or whatever. Like, why has U.S. inflation been mitigated, if we're going to be honest about it? Even if we don't like being honest about it, why is it mitigated? It's actually very simple. And it does have to do with why the Federal Reserve, when they think the inflation is out of control, will raise rates. It's because when things become more expensive, we tend to buy what we need, and we even make tighter decisions about that, but we really curtail spending on what we want. That's why. So Well, this would be a common thing that would, when you take this across hundreds of millions of people, you know, 100 million plus families in this country, would have a marked reduction in spending. Bill and his wife Tammy and two kids go out to eat, you know, about once a week. Under this new economy, eventually Bill and his wife decide we can't afford to go out eat every week. So they still go out to eat, and they go out every other week, and they take two meals out that they were eating out with their kids. The two meals now cost more than they used to, but they don't cost that much more. And Bill and Tammy have actually reduced the household monthly spending on wants by reducing the number of meals they eat out. Now do it with everything. Bill and Tammy get the electric bill and go, holy shit. And then they're like, what did you kids do? Right? Because their contract ended, they had their new contract year and a new electrical rate, and they look at their usage, and the usage is damn near the same as it was last month, but the bill went up 35%. So Bill and Tammy then become Voltar, evil overlord of the electricity, and teach their children, turn the fucking lights off, and they turn the thermostat up a few degrees, and they spend less money on electricity. Now keep going. What I'm saying is, one of the reasons that a lot of these socialist countries experience the type of runaway inflation that they do, where we always seem to, at some point when we go too far to stupid town, get into kind of a sideways stagflationary type scenario, whether it's exactly like the 70s or more like what we're experiencing now that has, like, it rhymes with the 70s, but it's not the same as. We don't live in a complete welfare state. We don't live in a complete socialist state. We are somewhat capitalist and somewhat fascist in the way that we live. So we have socialist elements, but it's not full socialism. So in a lot of these countries, incomes are tied directly to rates of inflation. So as inflation goes up, people get more money. The reason they were printing a $1 trillion bill in Nigeria is to give it to people. So since we have to earn our bread by the sweat of our brow, at least about half the population does, then there's a point where we rein the spending in due to the expense. And even the people that are on the dime, right, the people that are getting paid by the government to exist, whether people earned it because they're in their retirement years or whether people got there either from real or faked injuries and got on disability, or people that are on straight-up welfare programs, they have been given more money over the past 3 years. There's been increases in the amount of, but it has not kept pace with inflation. They too then must curtail their spending. So all of this is to say, all of these freaking PhDs and shit, they can't figure it out. The reason inflation has come into check is because spending has decreased as costs have gone up. Now, you'd think they'd cover that in, I don't know, like fucking 10th grade economics 101, where Mr. Larson taught me that when I was 15 fucking years old. But apparently they don't teach this economic theory anymore, that when the cost of living goes up, people naturally restrain spending. So when you see inflation mitigated in a situation like we're in, it is not signs that the economy is good or recovering. It's showing you, if you look at it for real, without any of your political rose-colored glasses and trying to make a case for either side, that people are at their fucking breaking point. That's what it means. It means you have a country where the majority of the population is existing right on the knife edge of bankruptcy. And you will never have runaway inflation and that situation at the same time unless the money you're printing is also being given to the population. So if we went into like a UBI model, if we brought back what we did during COVID where they gave everybody the stimulus checks, and we just started sending every family $10,000 extra a year, and trust me, there's people that would like to do it, the inflation that would take off if we did that right now would be absolutely insane. It would be absolutely insane. If you want to know why it didn't happen during COVID, I told you it wouldn't happen during COVID while it was happening, while they were giving the money out. You're throwing a pile of money into a hole. You have to fill the hole up before you start to get a pile. Additionally, spending was deeply curtailed because people couldn't go out and do stuff. COVID ended, people went out and did stuff, they had a whole bunch of new money, and they kept making money, and interest rates stayed low, and boom, boom, it exploded. Am I saying that Joe Biden doesn't get 100% of the blame for all the inflation? Yes, I am. I absolutely am. Does that mean he did a good job with the economy? That's not what I said. He did a shitty job with the economy. The things that were done that were already going to play out could have been mitigated. Instead, they were accentuated and exaggerated. Trump gets blamed. Obama gets blamed. Bush gets blamed. If you take the graph back to 1971, there's no big spikes. There's a spike here and a spike there, and it self-corrects over time. That's what I'm telling you. This entire system is the problem. It doesn't matter who's president. It doesn't matter who the Secretary of Treasury is. It doesn't matter who the Federal Reserve Chairman is. Those are tactical decisions when you do a thing and how you do it for what purpose that will have mitigation or aggravation on the short-term trend. But the long-term will look the same no matter who's in charge, and eventually it will all explode. Now, I don't know why a person with a PhD in economics from an Ivy League university can't explain that to you, but probably not because they don't know it. No matter how much they've eaten the Keynesian or drank the Keynesian Kool-Aid, they probably know that every word that I just said was true. And if they were forced to debate somebody like me, they'd fall back to, what do you know? You don't have a PhD in economics, you redneck. But inside, they think, damn, how does he know that? They're not saying it because it's not in the script that they're allowed to say right now. That's all there is to it. And it's why you need to be planning for your economic future with uncertainty about when a thing will happen, but certainty about what's going to happen. There will be a massive economic reboot of the United States dollar as a monetary system for the world. Whether that's BRICS breaking its back, whether that's the United States doing it itself and rebasing the currency on something, that we don't know. But we do know that this game, this gimmick, this gambit that began in 1913, ramped up in 33 and 64, but really went into terminal stupidity in 71, is reaching the end of its life expectancy. And just saying, be prepared for that. And yes, Bitcoin and precious metals should be part of your reserve capital if you actually want to be prepared for whatever happens, because no, we don't know exactly what it will look like. With that, we've wrapped things up with news shows for the week anyway. We will have a Friday flashback tomorrow. And I'll just say here at the end, if you like the show and you want to help us out, you know what to do. Do your online shopping beginning at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. Another reminder, because I'm not going to hear from people who say, I didn't know, and I've said it every day for the last week now. September 21st, Saturday morning, 9 a.m. Central Standard Time. Not your time zone unless you're in Central Time Zone. 9 a.m. Central Time, Saturday the 21st. That's next Saturday, not this Saturday coming up. The fall workshop will go on sale, and you have got to be in the Telegram group and or channel. Either will work. That is when I will drop the link. It will sell out, you know, if it does like last year, in 2 minutes. It will not last an hour. I will tell you that. There's enough chatter and back end I want to come that I know this is going to be a quick one. Again, I don't do this for marketing purposes. I don't do this to make... I'm going to sell out. I could literally say, hey, I'm putting on sale right now. It'll still sell out in a day with no pre-marketing, okay? I'm doing it so that anybody... Because here's how I feel about it. Anybody that really, really, really wants to come has a very high... I'm going to say not will get to come. Will have a very high probability of coming. Because other than last year and one other time... There were still times 10 minutes in, there was still like five for sale, and one would come in, and then another 5 minutes. Like most years, it's more like that. So if you get up and you're ready to go, and that link drops and you click it, you should have plenty of time to get signed up for it if you want to come. It is going to be an awesome workshop. I feel like we put one of the best absolute lineups ever together. The food lineup is crazy good as well. We've learned a lot over the years. I think the way we feed you for 3 days, you'd have a hard time doing it for yourself for the amount of money we charge for the whole thing. So anyway, with that, I will wrap up. Thank you again for tuning in. Remember that Cover Cop course is on sale as well. It can always use your support as a member. And have a great weekend. Again, tomorrow we'll have that flashback for you, an old interview, and starting Monday we'll do it all over again. Run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way. Let me show you a better way.